Hello, everyone. Welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santamaria, and we've got a really fun episode for you today. I have a chance to sit down with Dr. Shinny Samara from Techno on Al Jazeera America. And if you've heard of that before, or you think you might have seen it, maybe you did, because I'm on it too. But before we jump into that, I wanted to give a big shout out to everybody who supports the podcast in all of the ways that you do. Thank you so much for going on to iTunes and Stitcher and rating and reviewing the podcast. Thank you so much for visiting carasantamaria.com, perusing around and possibly shopping in the online store. And thank you to all of the podcast's patrons who support the show through my PayPal portal or through my Patreon account, which you can find at patreon.com/talknerdy. That's patreon.com/talknerdy. So big shout out today to Kimberly Swanson. I want to say a big thank you to Chuck Pell, Jeffrey Sewell, Brian Holden, and Rob Barcy. And an extra big thank you to, Ron Kanoblock for your amazing support that you've been giving week after week after week. And an extra big thank you to my two newest big supporters, Ahmed Ali and Zachary Moroccan. Thank you guys so much. And Zachary, I will be shipping you something to say thank you right here at the end of the month, which is only in about a week. So yeah, couldn't do it without you guys. I can't express how grateful I really am. And we are very close to getting those new microphones. I think this will be the cycle that we can do it. I'm so pumped. Soon I will sound the same as my guests and I won't be 1,000% louder and needing to edit as much as I do now. Anyway, all right, business aside, please welcome Dr. Shinny Samara. Hey, Shinny, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited. I just noticed in my voice, though, when I said, thank you so much for joining me today, I sounded very Midwestern. Oh, thank you. And you sound very British.
Yeah. And these microphones and headphones make it sound very seductive.
It does, doesn't it? It's like this great kind of echo and maybe a little like 1-900 number. I'm really thrilled to be sitting down with you because we've worked now together for like literally years, which is super weird. But we haven't spent that much time together. And I'm really looking forward to getting to know you. I think I know on camera you, which is probably still you, but to know you, I think we'll be excited. So for people who don't know, even though I probably just introduced you in something I'm recording later, this is always very confusing. For people who don't know, you work on the same show that I work on, except you work on it all the time because you're full-time on the show, called Techno on Al Jazeera America. I work on it very, like, rarely. I just started my first story in almost a year.
Because you're so busy, girl.
Just so crazy. And also the show is, they're starting, I feel like, and maybe I'm wrong, but to use obviously you and Phil more often because you and Phil are full-time employees and kind of still use the correspondents that that are on the show. Who would that be? That would be me, Crystal.
Lindsay,
Marita, and probably Costa. Are the five that are most often used, right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, we have our core group.
Yeah. And so, but really, we are there to service the fact that sometimes you have multiple segments in an episode, sometimes episodes shoot in other parts of the country where we don't live. But Lindsay and Marita are East Coasters, right?
Yeah, I think we're all around the country.
Yeah.
And I think I'm full-time because I came a long way to be on this show.
Exactly.
So I can't really go back that
exactly
easily.
So let's talk about that. So early on, I remember the very first episode, you weren't quite here yet to shoot any of the field segments, but you came in for the wraps and it was like, welcome from across the pond. And so how did you first get involved with Al Jazeera? Were you working for Al Jazeera English or did you know anybody there?
No, I'd never worked for Al Jazeera.
Oh,
at
interesting.
All. I'd done BBC stuff and Discovery and those various networks back home in London. And I don't know if it was a chance meeting in Doha of some Al Jazeera execs or whether I was on their radar anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But they were looking for a scientist to be part of this show. And I happened to go to Doha for the summer because my sister lives there.
Oh,
and she's a vet.
Okay.
And she looks after the animals of some, you know, executives over there. And so she put me in touch with them and we had a chat. And then one thing led to another. And I was in LA doing the screen test with you. I think the first episode mm-hmm. that we shot
yeah.
was together. And that was really us screen testing. Do you remember we had those technical things where we were kind
oh
of like,
God, yes,
the swipes and the pointing.
It was something with like the, with like a Kinect or, yeah. you know, one of those like Kinect video box. Game things. Yeah, yeah. It was such a pain in the ass. I'm so glad they were like, yeah, we're not doing that.
We're not going to do that. Although like, we had it locked down
we
by
did
the
finally.
End of that day.
You picked it up a lot faster. I remember you were like, okay, and then, and coming up next, whoosh, blah, blah, blah. And every time I would do it, I was like, psh, fuck, psh, fuck. Everybody's like looking over.
We, it had great intentions for looking really techy.
Yeah, exactly.
But in sometimes the end, we just like, settled for coffee. And
exactly. Sometimes the more high tech, I think, the more chance something has to break.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting. I mean, I've got to back up a little and ask, like, first of all, because this is a total aside, why does your sister live in Qatar?
I know, and she's got a Swedish husband.
That's so strange. And she's I mean, you guys grew up in the UK?
Yeah, born okay. and raised in London. Mm-hmm. I've lived there my whole life. She's been there a few years now because her husband, who is a banker, wanted to invest Middle Eastern money because the European financial markets were going down. Mm-hmm. Down the drain. And
gotcha.
So they moved over there and they got married beforehand. And so just really like total coincidence that Doha happens to be, you know, the HQ of yeah. Al Jazeera.
Does she like it there?
She loves her family change. Unit.
Yeah.
So
kind
you know,
of anywhere she
when
is.
When you're married, it's all that honeymoon stage. And so mm-hmm. you could be anywhere on the planet as long as you have each other. And so they're happy there and they've just had a baby.
Yeah.
So.
I
so
definitely
a great life.
Feel like if I was going to spend any time, I guess in the Middle East, that would be where I would go, right?
Maybe I think I'd choose Dubai.
Dubai, yeah, you're yeah. right. That would probably be better.
There's a lot of sand yeah. in Dubai and Qatar.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's really for me.
It's tough. Well, I have a friend who, she was actually on the podcast many, many episodes ago. I talked to her before she left, but she had just recently finished her PhD at Caltech in astrophysics. And then she took a position at a university in Saudi Arabia. Ooh. Which is tough. And
apparently it's a lot more strict.
Yes. And so we were talking about, it was interesting because we were talking about what it's going to be like. And she had visited, I think, at that point, but she hadn't, you know, been there. So I think it'll be really interesting when she comes back to visit, or if she does ever come back, to kind of see what it really is like. Because I can't imagine how you could be prepared to go someplace. Basically, the big issue is just where, as a woman, you have to like go outside with a chaperone. Like, it's just a totally different world.
Yeah. I mean, she had to ask permission from her husband. She had to get written permission, which obviously he was going to give.
Uh-huh.
But to open a bank account, to drive.
And this is like a more, I would say, liberal.
Yeah, this is the more of the
progressive kind of Middle Eastern country,
definitely.
Qatar. That's yeah. crazy. So she had to get permission to open a bank account to be able to drive. But she... People don't really wear burqa. Do they wear burqas? They do. Okay. So it just depends
so
on how
strict.
Religious you are.
They're not so strict with the expats.
Gotcha.
So she doesn't.
Yeah.
But
so it's not so much a state sanctioned thing. It's more like an individual, like certain families decide
yeah,
that's what they want
to
do.
Yeah, it's those that respect the religion and the culture over there, you know, respect the traditions. But my sister doesn't. And I'm actually really curious to see what happens when she returns back to Europe because they intend to go back to Sweden and live there. And I'd like to see her adjust because, you know, when we go out, we see women kind of dressed in whichever way they see fit.
Oh, yeah. We live in Hollywood.
Yeah.
we see some interesting
things. So you see a lot of people not dressed.
Exactly.
Actually. And she's not exposed to any of that. So I think she's kind of, you know, her husband is hers. She doesn't have to worry about anything. And
yeah.
So I'm really curious to see how she copes.
Sweden will be a culture shock for her. I definitely, I've actually never visited Sweden. I've traveled a lot in Europe. I've never been to Sweden. But I did have a friend when I was in college No, that was high school, who was Swedish, very Swedish. And he showed us some of his what would you call them? Like the yearbooks from previous years when he was back home. And these were high school age kids, like 14, 15 year old kids. And their class photos would be like crazy weird. It would be, because sometimes, you know, you do a funny picture or maybe you're all in costume, but theirs would be like creepy weird. It was like, there was one that was like, everybody was dressed like a baby. And so, but it was literally like 15 year old kids and they were all wearing diapers and the girls were just like in bras.
Okay.
And you were like, "What? How is this appropriate?" And they were like, he was like, what are you talking about? Like, it did not faze him, because I think Sweden is definitely a culture where we don't remember or realize, and I don't think England is that different from the U.S. in many respects, because we're kind of like, mm-hmm, but we don't realize how sexually repressed we are here.
Do you
like,
think?
Oh, yeah. Like, wow. Think about the Middle East and we're like, oh, shit. Yeah, like, we look definitely. At them and we're like, you're so sexually repressed. But I think in like Sweden and Germany and Finland, they look at like the U.S. and England and they're like, what the fuck? Like, there's nudity in commercials.
Yeah.
In certain parts of the world. And I think Sweden is definitely one of those kinds of countries.
That has nudity or not?
Oh, yeah. And so I think your sister's going to be like,
didn't they invent the sauna or something?
Exactly. Like, your sister's going to be like, what is happening?
I can't wait. That's actually hilarious. Want to like accompany her back home just to see the shock on her face.
But yeah, my friend Dr. Lockwood, Alex, she's living in a country where, yeah, you can't leave the house without full body coverage. And so she mostly, I think, just stays. This university kind of compound is there are a lot of like expats and foreign nationals that live there. And so I think it's one of those things where you just don't leave, because there you don't have to wear a head covering and you don't have to. But the minute you walk into the city, you have to cover and you have to have a male like chaperone, which is like, at a certain point, I guess if you absolutely have to leave to do that, you do. But at a certain point, it's like, it's not worth it.
Well, when I was in Doha, I was there during Ramadan, and you're not supposed to eat during the day. And I was doing this crazy diet thing, so I wasn't really eating. And then we went to a supermarket and I was just famished, and I had to like buy 6 apples or whatever just to munch on, just to see me through till dinner time. And as soon as I bought them, I was in this mall, and as soon as I bought them, I cracked open the packet and I was munching on this apple in the mall. Uh-huh. And I got told off. Someone came up to me and said, you do realize that you're completely disrespecting whatever the national holiday was called.
And, yeah.
And I felt so bad. And my Swedish brother-in-law said, you actually got off really lightly, because in Saudi Arabia, his friend did a similar thing and got like lashings.
Yeah.
I don't know how.
Yeah.
That
like some sort of horrible punishment.
Yeah.
And it's like, but wait, I'm not Muslim. Like, I don't, you know, but also it must be interesting for you too, because you are British, but what is your ethnic like background? What are your parents? Where are your parents from?
So technically, my parents are Buddhist.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're
my mother's Malaysian. My father's Sri Lankan.
Gotcha. Yeah. And so Sri Lanka is obviously a very Muslim country also, is it not?
No.
Oh, really?
No, it's actually, if anything, it's mostly Catholic.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. It's an interesting mix. And Malaysia is even more mixed. I mean, you've got every religion you could possibly think of. And that's mostly Muslim. Mm-hmm. But you also have Buddhists and Catholics.
But Sri Lanka's not mostly. Okay. I was totally confused by that. I don't know why. I'm like, I'm basing this off of like listening to MIA. I have no idea. But so obviously, because you have darker skin, if you are in a country like somewhere in the Middle East and you're not speaking, like if you don't open your mouth, there may be an assumption. Probably not, because of, I mean, how do you dress when you go to Doha?
Conservative.
Okay, you do. Okay.
Yeah. I do the maxi dresses and cover up.
That there may be an assumption that you are, you know, either native or that you are definitely Muslim. Like, why are you here otherwise? And so, you know, you're not blonde hair, blue eyed, and then they're like, oh, she's here on, you know, she's traveling.
Definitely.
So, yeah.
It's an interesting mix of people. You get, I mean, because it is really a center of, I mean, it's,
It's like Hong Kong in a way.
The world, yeah, that introduces all kinds of different ethnicities.
Exactly, and it's a big business center too. I mean, it's like an economic boom kind of area, and so yeah, you probably just like Hong Kong, you probably have so many people that aren't even, what are they, Qatari?
Yes,
Qatari, is that what you would say? Very small country.
Yeah,
a lot of people don't know it exists.
It's interesting flying over there, like. You know, it's always, I'm always kind of gripping onto my airplane seat
when we're
passing through kind of Iraq and flying over Baghdad and things like that.
Wow.
I am always a bit nervous, to be honest.
And it's so, didn't we have some colleagues? We have some colleagues on the show who started out doing techno because they had come from Current back when they had worked on the Young Turks. And then during the merger or the purchase, actually, they stayed on at Al Jazeera. And ultimately, because of like some rounds of layoffs and some kind of reconfiguring of things, they went to Doha and they just worked
there
full time.
They visited
lived there.
Them.
Oh, you did? Oh, how fun.
Because I was there last summer because my nephew was born.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So I went
to
visit for that reason. And then I just went to the offices and I saw.
Was it so
fun? Our colleagues. Yeah, they were having a fantastic time.
So they love it there.
Okay, how can you not have a great time if you spend 6 hours and you're in the Maldives?
Yeah.
They go there for the weekend. You know, people do that.
Yeah.
It's just so fantastic. Or you can kind of like drive dunes or, you know, take a 2 hour flight and you're in, I don't know, Jordan or just other places.
It's true. So. I will say, like, I'll follow Lucas, who was one of the producers on the show who ended up going and working there. I follow him on Instagram, and it's just stunning architecture, beautiful beach. It's all, he's always going cool places and taking pictures of cool things. And you forget, living in the U.S., I mean, this must be a big transition for you. We're kind of isolated out here. It's, like, super expensive to go anywhere. If you can travel for just miles and miles and days and still be in the same fucking country where everybody speaks the same language and they're not that, and culturally, I mean, there are obviously big cultural differences between the North and the South and whatever, but it's still all the U.S. And even if you cross country, you know, borders and you go to Canada, it's like not that different.
Yeah, I mean, it really was exciting for me coming here because, you know, having lived in London my whole life, you take 2 hours and you could be in such different places, whether it's kind of France or Germany or Switzerland or Italy or Spain.
Yeah,
or
that sounds way cooler. That sounds,
I mean, it's
way
so
cooler.
Amazing. In wintertime, we're skiing. In summertime, we're on the south of France, you know, like kind of sunning ourselves. And it's fantastic from London. I mean, London really is a gateway to so many different cultures. And but at the same time, what I was excited about coming here was the fact that I could do the road trips. I could go see Yellowstone. I could do Yosemite. I could.
Really?
You know, I still really want to see so much. And I haven't had time because techno's been so busy.
Yeah.
But also through techno, I've got to see a lot of America.
And the cool thing about working on a show like this is that you find yourself, there's like a really loud truck outside, is that you find yourself going to places that aren't necessarily touristy kind of, they're not metropolitan areas. They're places you would never just buy a plane ticket and go stay in a hotel. So you visit, in some respects, like the real, quote unquote, I hate to say that, but America, you go to places that are, most people think of as pass through places, but they in and of themselves are destinations.
Totally.
I love that. I love going to these random towns and meeting with these people and seeing like the culture there and going to the festivals. And
yeah,
it's so
absolutely.
Much fun.
I mean, one of the favorite places was going to New Hampshire because it kind of felt like home.
Really?
It was so beautiful. Yeah. Trees, greenery. I mean, the leaves were turning. It was stunning. And why would I ever go to New Hampshire? You know, I'd probably go to New York.
You would go to New York or maybe, yeah, probably just New York.
Yeah.
Maybe Vermont. People talk about Vermont like it's really beautiful like that, but still, you don't visit that
is
often.
It?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Vermont's like a very beautiful state.
Yeah. I really want to go there.
Orange, especially in fall. Yeah. Mm. It's stunning.
I'm trying to work on a story.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. It's like, what is happening in Vermont?
Yeah. Let's find the tech in Vermont.
That's hilarious. So basically, I want to back up and talk about, so you've lived in London your whole life. You are, you know, a science person just like everybody else who works on. That's what I think is so great about techno is that every single correspondent has a strong science background. and was really actively immersed in their respective fields and also vastly different fields. Mm. And so, you know, like Crystal and I both studied neuroscience. She really studied neuroscience. I kind of stopped short before she did. And then you've got Phil, for example, who is like going
crazy
to the Amazon.
About butterflies.
Yeah, he's like the butterfly guy and he's spending time in the Amazon. And you've got all these different great kind of angles. And your angle, correct me if I'm wrong, is engineering.
Yeah, originally mechanical engineering, and then I specialized in computational fluid dynamics. Oh. So that's the software that allows engineers to visualize the invisible. So we'll get to see how air flows in buildings or around aircraft wings or Formula One cars. We can model how it looks when someone sneezes, you know, just the things you don't see that involve air and liquids and fluids and gases. And
that's
things.
So cool. Yeah. So you, what is the educational system like? And how does it compare? And maybe you don't know how we go to school over here, but when do you first kind of have to make the decision about what it is you want to study and what it is you want to be?
Yeah, good question, because it's changing
really
all the time. But when I was studying around the age of 13 or 14, I had to choose that I was going to go into the sciences.
Really?
Which kind of broke my heart.
That's insane. That's like so early.
So it doesn't happen here?
No. No. Oh. You usually don't even have to establish your major. I guess if you're, you know, at an Ivy League or like a tier one university and you really want to know what's up. But even then, you don't technically have to know until you start college. And for a lot of people, not until a few years into college. So anywhere between 18 and 20, you're still figuring out what you want to do.
Gosh,
yeah.
That was such a different story for me, because around 13, I really did have to choose, and maths was not my strong point.
Yeah.
And having quite a pushy father who's also a mechanical engineer, he was like, you're doing the sciences. So I really had to be good at maths. And so all my attention focused to just being great at, you know, working with figures and algebra and the sciences and stuff. And I had to let go of my true passions, which were kind of like the arts and drama and performance and things like that. And really, actually, the only way that I had that creative outlet was to do ballet on the side. And
oh, you were a dancer.
Yeah.
That's great.
I did
great.
That for 20 years.
Wow. Do you ever talk to Crystal about that? She was a professional
I should.
Dancer.
We never get the chance, but we've mentioned things, you know, and I love the Instagram posts that she has of
her sister.
Her sister
is still doing, and she does ballet. Yeah, Crystal did modern dance, but I'm sure she had to learn, you know, you have to learn all of
it.
But her sister is still, stunning, the images that they post. Also, like, she gets all of my old clothes when I can't zip them up anymore.
Who does, Crystal or her sister?
Her little sister, Noelle. I'm like, once upon a time, I could wear those jeans.
So I know. Sad. It happens to all of us.
I know. But yeah, so you did ballet for 20, you said 20 years?
Yeah, kind of insane at the time when I was studying mechanical engineering, and I was like taking apart engines and, you know, cogs and gears and ball bearings and stuff. And then in the evenings, I'll be like putting on the point shoes and pirouetting around the room.
That is, you've got your like pink satin shoes and like like oil and grease under your fingernails.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's actually really cool. But I also feel like that should be a commercial. That should be an ad campaign, or it should be a television character, something so that little girls can see that, like, you can totally do both. You know what I mean? You can totally get in there and get dirty and still have this, what some people would consider, I guess, a more feminine, creative outlet and enjoy it. Although I think it's kind of a bummer to think of ballet as feminine, because there are plenty of men who dance.
Yeah. And also, it's interesting that crossover between the masculine feminine thing, because at the time when I was kind of crossing those boundaries, it wasn't really commonplace. And today I talk a lot in schools and I try and inspire girls to go into STEM. And the girls are so badass these days. They're just like kind of, I mean, it's just the norm to do everything and kind of contradict yourself. And so I kind of feel like the uncool one now, whereas before I was really singled out. I mean, on my engineering course, there was 140 of us studying mechanical engineering, and 9 of us, including me, were girls.
Oh, my God. Isn't that terrible? And it's getting better, but it's still pretty bad, especially in engineering. Like, when you look at the STEM, you know, the science, technology, engineering, math, it's the engineering that's really suffering the most. some sciences, of course, the more you get into the physical sciences, the lower the female enrollment. But even still, at the undergrad level, at least in the U.S., you're approaching 50-50 early on. Mm. And then you start to see the women kind of leaking out of that pipeline. And even in math, there are plenty of undergrad departments in math where, maybe it's not 50-50, but maybe it's 60-40. But by the time you get up to the tenured professor level, it's like all men and very few women. But in engineering, even in the coursework early on, it's like just women aren't doing it.
I wonder how much of it is to do with the actual subject and how much of it is about having to work with men.
Yeah.
Because it was difficult, studying engineering for 8 years in total, and four and a half were in industry because my doctorate was sponsored by a company. So I was immersed in engineering, and it was a really masculine environment, and you had to grow a thick skin. There was no choice. And I think some women just think, why bother? I'm not gonna subject myself to having to harden in this way.
And so not just not having other women to talk to, or not being maybe always taken 100% seriously, but did you actually see, experience a lot of hardcore like misogyny and sexism? And
I think I did, and I'm actually grateful for it because it really toughened me up. Mm-hmm. But it was just, the comments like, oh, you're doing your computer modeling, the modeling again. And it's because I was actually modeling at the time. So I was like, I've always had crazy contrast in my life. So it was like, I was doing engineering, and then often I'd, go to castings and whatever. And it was like, so which modeling are you doing today? And so I was kind of, I had set myself up for that kind of.
Yes and no, though, because I feel very strongly that, I think it's good for girls to, it's good for everybody. It's good for men, too, to not be so singularly focused in life, because that can make you insane. Like, I think it's good to have outlets. But at the same time, it is that kind of assumption, I guess, that women are inherently better at doing, like, brainless things that are superficial, and they're inherently worse at doing thinky things that require a lot of brain power. And I don't know, like, giving a girl shit for that. Like, oh, like almost like you have to choose because you can't be good at both.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This pressure of like, because how would a guy feel if you were like, I don't know, making fun of him for being too feminine or for being too masculine? They probably like that, actually.
I think that gap has widened, though. Narrowed.
Yeah.
It's narrowed now. So people are just like, oh, that person looks that way, but is a brain surgeon. Like, okay, we get it. And especially here in America.
Getting better. And the awareness is raising a lot, but it's still pretty crazy. I read a book semi-recently called Another Day in the Frontal Lobe by Katrina Furlick. It's interesting you mention a brain surgeon. She's a brain surgeon. She's a neurosurgeon. And I think there's only 40, is it 40? It's a really low number, like 40 female neurosurgeons in the country.
Wow.
And she talks about what it's like doing your undergrad, then going through medical school, and then doing your residency. Because a neurosurge is like the upper echelon. It's like a 10-year residency or something. It's like you've got to do all the neuro stuff. You've got to do all the surgery stuff. You can't have a life. Like, the only way to get through it is to, like, not have anything else going on in your life. And so she talks about what that's like, and how just it's all dudes. And I can't imagine. And, I think that you're right. I think we're getting better because I think there's a lot of reasons we're getting better. But I also appreciate the fact that I think it's less and less acceptable to just, like, be a dick. Like, you just can't be, like, overtly sexist anymore unless you're doing it behind closed doors, because everybody's like, dude, like, you can't get away. It's not Mad Men anymore. You can't get away with it. But and that helps. But even I would say if we culturally find ourselves in a place, let's say, imagine when you were working on your engineering degree, if there was no misogyny and no sexism at all, and all the guys were incredibly supportive and almost didn't see gender, or they, when they did see gender, they saw it in a very fair and balanced way, but still there were only 9 of you versus 140 whatever men, even that is enough to kind of fuck with your head. Even if there's no impropriety, just not being around other women.
I don't know. I learn a lot.
Yeah.
Being surrounded by guys. I mean, you know, there are differences and I'm not judging them to be better or worse, but men and women are very different.
Completely.
And I really appreciated learning so much from guys. I mean, they were very focused, very ambitious, very driven. You know, once a month, the girls kind of got in that kind of that state. And it's like, oh, God.
But you know what?
To put up with eight of you doing that.
I think guys do it too. They just do it throughout the day. You know what I mean? It's like, whereas a girl, maybe once a month, we're a little more like weepy or angry or whatever. And like most of us are victims of that. Obviously, it's our biology. I think with guys, it's not once a month. It's like once a day, they'll get like really hangry.
For the whole month. Once a day for the whole month. We're just a week. God, we're so simple.
Yeah, right. Biologically, it's so funny. We're so fucking confusing.
That was great to kind of like see how the guys did it and learn something. And I think, you know, having nine girls on the course added a softer touch.
Oh, I think it's very important to have. And also, I think that's why it's very important to have a mix of ethnicities, a mix of sexual identities, a mix of all of those kinds of things. Because, yeah, if ever, it's not even so much about men versus women or white guys versus black guys. It's about like when you all have a similar background, when you come from the same place and you have similar privilege, you think the same way. Mm. And so being able to have people, like you were saying, having a softer touch, having maybe a more like a fairness approach as opposed to a more competitive approach or whatever those things are. And I don't think they're always implicit in being male or female. I think that there are huge trends, obviously. Mm. But let's say there were probably men in your department that you might not even notice because they're overshadowed by the other guys that are also very, have a very soft touch, but you don't know. And maybe there's like a woman who's like, she's so like, watch out for her. She's a monster. But in general, yeah, just having a variety of people.
Yeah. I mean, we definitely had a very diverse team. The only thing that every single one of us had in common in the company was that we were all terrified of flying because we're all such experts in fluid dynamics and how air flows, and we're like, I am not getting in that metal tube
that is
supposed
so
to stay
funny.
Up there for 12 hours. No way.
And so are you still scared of flying?
Yeah, I'm because
you fly all the time for Al Jazeera.
And I absolutely love traveling.
Yeah,
that's the irony, is that I love traveling, seeing new places, discovering, you know, going on adventures.
But you want to just already be there.
Yeah,
you
don't, I just want to get there. I don't want the flying bit scares me.
Are you like a white knuckled flyer?
And I was only like that when I started engineering. Oh, before God, that, like, so ignorance funny. Was bliss, you know? And then, yeah, once I started learning about it, I was like, I just can't believe that one simple equation is the one thing that's keeping us up right now.
Yeah. Oh, that's so scary. So what do you do when you fly? Do you like pop a couple pills and go to sleep, or do you?
No, I'm just completely like, I don't drink and I don't take like pills and stuff like that. And so I don't know what I do. I just
try not to think
about
it.
Shut down mentally. Yeah.
I think there is something, though. I think for almost everybody, I mean, even people who aren't afraid of flying, I'm not a bad flyer at all. Like, I just could give two shits. When there's turbulence, I'm like, it's fine. I'm really bad in airports. I hate airports. That's my least favorite part of travel. I get really stressed when I'm at the airport. But flying is whatever. But I think it's because it's a decision I make in my brain that says, I literally have no control over this situation. And once you kind of give up that control and you go, my life is in the hands of the pilot. Like, because if we're going down, we're going down. Like, I can't fucking do anything about it. I have no skills in this scenario. I cannot help, you know? Then you just, I don't know. There's a certain freedom that comes from just being like letting go.
I think that's where my major problem is, because whenever I'm on a plane, I have to sit above, like on the same plane as the wings, because, you know, turbulence.
It's harder in the front and the back, for sure.
And then, like, I'm constantly, I usually get off a plane with like a stiff neck because my head is just turned permanently towards the window, and I'm just like looking at how the wings change and like, oh, okay, they're extending the flaps now, which means we're gliding.
So you know all of the stuff.
Yeah, my head is like, shut up. stop thinking about this stuff.
Oh, yeah, that's not good at all. That's like being a surgeon who has to go in for surgery. You know what I mean? It's like you can't let go. So when you were doing your research, I mean, I remember visiting USC for a story that I don't think I ever ended up doing back when I was at HuffPost. I don't think we ever ended up doing it, but there was a really cool researcher there who was doing like fun biomimicry work where they were trying to model new types of airplanes after animals and how animals fly. And I remember and they had one of those like wind tunnels where they would do all, they could visualize with like the fog and they could see all the, and I remember him saying something to me that really kind of struck me, which was the whole thing about like a cigar with wings, like the common airplane that we're, you know, a passenger plane that we're used to flying on, is the worst, like it was the worst way to build an airplane. Like the cigar with wings is like not at all aerodynamic. I mean, it is aerodynamic, obviously it does stay in the air, but like the kind of the way that we think of the B-52, the bombers, like that are like wide and flat, are much better at flying.
I mean, the more surface area you have of a plane, the better. And so if you've got this like fat kind of container with skinny wings, I mean, it's not ideal. But then they've designed it in the most efficient way to carry the most people and then, you know, carrying the fuel and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, the design is probably the best that they could come up with. But in terms of achieving flight, I mean, what you're aiming for is like a kite type design that can glide and doesn't need fuel to fly. It just can, you know, float on thermals.
Yeah,
that would be the ideal.
And it seems like the big issue, the reason that we don't fly in things that look like that, is literally because it would be weird for us. Like that's what everybody seems to say, that they're like, no, but people are just used to sitting in the aisles. You got the aisles and the windows and the whatever. And if we were spread out like that in such a way that there was a huge area in the middle where just all the people had to be in the middle and nobody got to be around the outsides, and that people just wouldn't like it. And so they might not do it. Which is to me so funny, this idea of it's so important. I mean, we think about it, obviously, you look at an iPhone or something and it's like the most incredible technology, but also it's very user-friendly and intuitive and all of those that, you know, simple and easy to use. And it's so funny how much of technical marvels, scientific marvels, engineering really comes down to how sucky people are, just how much they're like
how
impatient
they are to people's, I don't know, perceptions or just
preferences. Such a psychology component of tech, especially when we're talking about tech that people use every day, flying in a plane, getting on your phone, that we could have the most amazing algorithm that does the coolest stuff, but if it doesn't load really quickly or if it's not like easy with a button, people just will be like, fuck this sucks. Which is so crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think planes were designed so that people would want to go on them. Because I think when you've got a plane design, if you want to get to the other side of the planet, you're going to choose whichever way, you know.
So why do you think it is that there's a siren outside too? I live in a very noisy neighborhood. why do you think it is the whole cigar with wings instead of like the Concorde, like the, you know?
You can't really pack too many people in a Concorde.
That's why. It's just limited space. So it's not cost effective.
You're going to try and get as many people into that container as you can. And that was the best design.
Yeah.
But, I mean, when you look at the A380 and all these other kind of, that really is a loud.
Yeah, it was really loud. Well, it was also.
Are we okay?
Yeah, it was also literally went right by my apartment. Usually I live a couple blocks away from a major street. So usually when you hear sirens, they're like on Melrose, like on the major street. But that just like drove by my window. I was like, hi. Anyway, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, so like I think.
So it's about passenger. It's about like
packing
them
in.
Cost effective. Yeah. Packing them in, packing in their luggage and making sure that one ticket. Because you saw there, I feel like semi-recently there was a massive redesign of a lot of planes where they were able to add like six seats.
Well, those, you know, A380s are carrying what, 900 people or something crazy.
Oh my God, that's insane.
And all those 900 people are not going to get window seats. So there's going to be a lot of people that are stuck in the middle.
And you know what? I think some people don't mind that, which is crazy to me. I am a window seat girl through and through.
Me too.
When I get an aisle or a middle, I'm like, and that's the thing that people don't realize when you're, and granted, I'm not denigrating at all, but I love my job and I love that I get to travel all over the place and see the coolest stuff. But a lot of times when you're working production, A, we're not fucking flying first class. Like, get that thought out of your head right away. We're always flying coach. If we're lucky enough to have status only because we fly so much, we might get like an upgrade to you know, the coach with like the 2 inches more of leg room, like the economy plus or whatever they call
and
it.
And the seat that goes back just 1 inch
yeah,
more.
Yeah, 1 inch more, exactly. But it's so common when you're doing this kind of work that production schedules come together last minute, blah, blah, blah. And you're told, you know, it's a Tuesday. Oh, you're flying on Thursday. Here's your flight on Wednesday. And so you have like the shittiest seat in the plane. This is very common.
Yeah.
It's very common.
I didn't know seats could be that close to the toilet.
Exactly. To be in like the middle seat in row 35. And you're yeah. like, this is
in
great.
With the parcels.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's not a glamorous
yeah,
job that
no,
we do.
Not always very glamorous at all. So we haven't even really, I mean, I guess we started talking about, God, it is so loud here today.
It's all that mechanical engineering.
Exactly. They knew you were here. You know, there's also like major, I think I mentioned this on another episode. There's major construction happening not two units there. I'm in a townhouse complex with 8 of us. And then there's a house next door. And then there's basically a lot where they just leveled, I think, 2 houses. And they're building those small lot, 3-story condos right. where it's like really close together, but technically you own your own place, and they've been working on it night and day, and I can't fucking sleep.
Cara, you're so descriptive about where you live. If you piece together all the podcasts, like, people could pinpoint you.
That's so true. It's good that I'm moving soon. Just in time. You're right. Shit. I'm so ridiculous. So we have talked a little bit about your research. I mean, but more generally, the fluid dynamic, what did you call it? You said you were doing the computational fluid dynamics.
Yeah.
Was that the right phrase?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because actually before computers, they were using wind tunnels.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, fluid dynamics as a academic subject has always existed. But the computational side of it has come in relatively recently.
Because there's a lot of modeling that you're able to do and like change this one thing and see what happens.
Yeah.
So when you say fluid dynamics, that specifically is referring to the movement of any sort of fluid through a substrate. So you can be talking about air. Yeah. You can be talking about water.
So the definition of a fluid is any liquid or gas.
Okay.
So the same software could be used to model how blood flows through a stent, for example.
Cool.
Or how water flows through a pipe, or how a ship sails. You know, anything that involves a liquid or a gas can be simulated on a computer screen.
It's so weird because I think when we think of the word fluid, we think of it as a synonym for liquid, not for gas. But gas is obviously...
Yeah, it's fluid. Like,
it's fluid, it moves.
Yeah, a solid is rigid. Mm-hmm. It doesn't change its structure. A fluid is bound together. It has volume. But it could be extremely changing, I guess.
Yeah, like it still is, it still has these bonds. It still has this molecular structure. It's just the more, I guess, gaseous it becomes, the more it goes in all directions. Whereas a liquid is still has like strengths like that keep it together.
Yeah.
Interesting. So what was your... Did you have a specialty? Was there a particular aspect of fluid dynamics that the computational side that you were really interested in?
Yeah. So looking back, I was actually studying the least sexy part of CFD, which is how air flows within enclosed spaces.
Okay.
And one of the probably the most poignant examples of that is how air flowed or didn't flow in the pyramids. So, you know, when they built those amazing structures and then they put the king and buried him in there and then shut the door, then, you know, that pyramid was full of gas, which in that environment being warm and humid bred bacteria over hundreds of years. And then when the archaeologists came in and opened that door for the first time in ages, they breathed in all of that toxic gas, and that's what killed them.
Wow.
And we still have the same effect in enclosed spaces, particularly high-rise buildings, where you can get stagnants or pockets of stagnant air. And it's because, you know, the air conditioning system doesn't quite reach that corner of the room. And so it's a perfect breeding ground for bacteria. And so you get this thing called sick building syndrome, where you can be working in a space in a tower block and just be getting sick every day because you're just breathing in this really disgusting air.
That's fascinating. I never would have thought about it. You think that just air moves.
Yeah.
You know what
Especially
I mean?
Especially in places like airplanes. We seem to be talking about them a lot today.
Oh, yeah.
But like, you know, the air filtration system on an airplane is crucial. I mean, we are all at the mercy. Like, forget about the pilots. You know, the air we're breathing is essential.
We're at the mercy of that guy who keeps farting. Damn that guy.
And no, so, you're lucky because, you know, thanks to the systems, it's filtered out.
Yeah, see, I never thought about that because people always go like, ugh, recycled air on airplanes is so gross. We're all just breathing each other's air. But it's probably actually cleaner than even like an open space because there's such good filtration.
There is.
That's good to know.
Yeah, but we can't filter out everything, which is why I always feel a bit groggy after a long
flight. I do too. And it just smells bad. Because even if you're filtering certain compounds out of the air and probably certain things that are dangerous, there are probably still molecules that are small enough that they fit through.
Yeah.
You know, like the farty molecule. I think that's the technical term, is the fart molecule. Super gross.
I'm sure I've come across that in papers. I'm sure I have.
So gross. So that's really fascinating. So you were really looking at these sick buildings and how can we better design, I guess I'm assuming, like the air circulation systems.
Yeah,
them.
We call them the HVAC systems.
Yeah.
So it's heating, ventilation, and air conditioning.
Oh, I guess that is what HVAC stands for. Ventilation is the V.
Yeah.
We always say like
it's
HVAC.
Actually heating, ventilation, and cooling.
And cooling. There you go.
Or it could be air conditioning as well.
Yeah. We always say HVAC, you know, the AC.
Yeah.
But of course there's heating and there's ventilation too. We don't think about that. Of course you want to cool your air and you want to heat your air, but you have to move your air.
Yes.
Like just having a fan run is
actually
pretty important.
There are standards. Back in the UK, we have to have 6 air changes per hour. So the air in a space gets refreshed 6 times.
Nice. And so, and it physically has to like leave the building.
Like you sucked out and blown back in.
Intake from somewhere else, suck it out. Yeah. And that's why we need things like hoods above our stoves.
Exactly. And whenever I now walk into rooms, I can't help but notice like where the grills are.
Oh, that's
where the
so funny.
Outlet, inlets. It's kind of weird. And the ironic thing is that I absolutely can't stand air conditioning.
Yeah.
Like, you know, put me outside in the sun here in California and I am a happy girl. And then like I'm always carrying around jackets because air conditioning is always set to so cold.
It's the worst when I notice this when we go on shoots. It's you're like, oh, it's going to be 90. Like I just got back from Florida. It was 95 degrees, super hot and humid. And you're like, oh, it's going to be so hot. So you think in your head, I need to pack for the heat. And you do because you have outdoor shoots. But then the minute you go inside, it's frigid because you never have that comfortable kind of dynamic. It's always, I grew up in Texas and it was like this all the time. You would be so hot outside and then you'd get in your car and blast the AC, or you'd be at like a shopping center and go inside. And not only is it so cold, but it's so conditioned. You know what I mean? It's just that
dry,
that refrigerant kind of, and it would give me such a bad headache.
Yeah, I can't stand it.
It's bad.
Like the first thing I do when I'm traveling on shoots is turn off the AC in my hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, like if truth be known, actually switch it over to heating. Like just get it nice and toasty for when I get back.
Oh, how funny.
Oh.
And when I fly, I have like a little travel kit in my backpack. I'm very neurotic flyer.
What's in it?
I love to sleep. So I always have fuzzy socks. It's very important for me if I'm traveling in like flip-flops or Uggs, because I'm one of those people who's like horrible. I always travel in pajamas. I do not look professional on a plane at all. I'm always wearing like leggings and a hoodie. And so I have fuzzy socks. I have always a pillow and a nice little fuzzy blanket. And then I have a little kit that when you open it up has, let's see, tissues, chapstick, nasal spray, gum, and then the most important thing for me is an eye mask, and I have these amazing headphones that are called sleep phones,
right.
And it's like a fuzzy headband, and the headphones inside of them are flat.
Oh.
It's so brilliant, and so they just go right up against your ears, and you can fall asleep in them. There's nothing in your ear.
There's no sound.
I have a nice little airplane music playlist, which is all very pleasing.
You're so organized.
I know.
I'm like running to the plane.
But I love to run to the plane too. I hate being there early. I love to just walk right on a plane. But there's just something about all that travel where if I'm awake through all that travel, I'm so like, I don't know, stressed when I get onto my shoot. I try to make myself able to basically just pass out the second I get on a plane. No matter what time of day it is, I always want to sleep on the plane.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just so excited/scared about being on a plane. So I'm just like, I can't sleep.
Maybe that's why I'm not scared, is because I'm literally unconscious the minute the plane takes off.
Yeah.
And then I wake up to the feeling of us landing almost every time.
Oh my gosh, I'm so envious. Okay, we're going to have to swap notes after this. You're going to have to tell me your secret.
And I don't take meds either. And definitely don't drink. I don't drink just in life.
Me either.
Oh, you don't?
No.
We're the sober club.
Sober.
I love that, especially in LA. People think
you have to be
fucking crazy, though, if you don't drink in LA.
Is it really?
You haven't noticed that?
Come on, I come from London. So, drinking is part of breathing.
London's more like New York in that way, where it's just like, that's all there is to do. There's a shitload of stuff to do, but for whatever reason, you have to be drunk while you do it. It's way more fun. Yeah, and I've never been a drinker.
And there's a pub on every corner in London. Yes. So it's like, you know, Sunday morning, what should we do? Go and have a Sunday roast in the pub. And then before you know it, you're kind of drinking and it's Monday.
And were you ever like a big drinker and you just decided not to be, or you just like you never were really that into it?
I was, you know, back home in London, I was part of the London going out crowd. So I was just, I was doing all of that. And then when I came to LA, I thought, you know what? LA just seems really serene. And it seems like a place where you can really, not detox, but you can live a very healthy life if you choose.
You definitely can. That is definitely true. I think most people don't realize that being healthy probably also means not drinking alcohol. It's pretty funny how in LA you definitely have the people who are like wearing their workout clothes every day and going on hikes and drinking their cold pressed juice and eating their macro diets and then like getting shit faced every night at the club, which is like kind of undoes it. But that being said, it is very easy for, you know, you can be vegan, you can be into raw foods, you can be gluten-free, you can be dairy-free, whatever your like weird diet is. And usually, sometimes it's just because you're trying to be trendy, but sometimes it's because you have a legit medical reason not to be able to do it. You can usually eat pretty well here.
Yeah, I definitely think the trends start here. Yeah. And then it filters back to London eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's really amazing to like be here where it all starts.
Oh, that's so fun. I don't think about it though. I guess because it never filters back to Texas. Texas definitely has its own identity. And let me tell you what, you cannot eat well in Texas.
I know. I was just in Austin and I ate so badly. It was so good.
It's so good.
Oh my gosh, the salt yard.
Salt Lick.
Salt Lick.
Yeah, yeah, the good barbecue.
Oh, my God.
Oh, it's so good. And hopefully you had, when I go back to Texas, it's the barbecue. And the place I love to go is called Rudy's. It's in Denton. Denton represent, if anybody's listening. It's basically like a gas station that also became this, like, it just kept growing and growing. And now it's this, like, massive, amazing barbecue place. Best thing on the menu there, giant baked potato full of chopped turkey and barbecue sauce.
Stop.
What?
Stop.
I also love, love, love a place called Babes, which is a fried chicken house. And there's like three things on the menu. Fried chicken, and chicken fried steak.
Love.
And also, I say this all the time and people think I'm insane. There's a donut place in Texas called Shipley's Donuts that I literally dream about. Like, I'll wake up in the middle of the night and think that I got to go to Shipley's and then be super disappointed when I realize I didn't get any donuts. Is there anything like that you miss in London?
You know, this is crazy, but one of the major things I miss is Vimto. It's a concept that doesn't exist here. It's it's basically cordial. Do you know?
I don't know. You're just saying words now. Wait, the first word you said was Vimto. Like V-I-M-P-T-O.
And what it is like a concentrated fruit juice that you mix with water. And normally I mix it with sparkling water.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so amazing.
Okay.
And so, like, it's a childhood taste that I miss so much.
And is it like, does it come in different flavors or is it all the same?
No, it's just berries. It's just Vimto as it is. It comes sugar-free or, like, full sugar. And
what is the second word you said? Cordial. Cordial.
So it's like, have you ever had like pressed elderflower juice that you mix with sparkling water?
Or
like,
no.
Honestly, the concept doesn't exist here in the States.
Yeah.
I have searched high and low and I have found it in New York, but it's like you can buy Vimto, the bottle of Vimto that you mix with water for like 69 pence. And in New York, it was like $12.
Oh my God.
So you know, when I went back to London, I just shipped a whole load back with me.
So you live not too far from me. Down the road in the other direction, there's actually one of those little like
wild markets.
No, it's like British only. It's like a little British only market, now like you an tell importer. Me? I know. I was just realizing.
How long have we known each other?
It's right by Subway. I don't know if it's any good. I've never been inside, but I always see it when I go to Subway to get a sandwich. They might have all that. They might have some Vimto.
Oh my gosh. Well, it's I'm now converted like to an American equivalent.
What is that?
Like,
what do you
it's basically flavored sparkling water.
Oh, yeah. People love that.
So, yeah.
I don't like sparkling water.
Really?
Is that weird? I don't like the bubbles.
I don't like it without taste.
I could see that because it's just odd.
Yeah.
It's like when they first put water in cans. You remember when they put water in cans?
It's just wrong.
And it was metallic tasting and weird. Although I do appreciate the idea because plastic bottles are horrible.
Oh, don't get me started. It's my latest segment for techno.
Oh, I'm excited to see it. Oh, that's so exciting.
It's been so fascinating. It's changed my lifestyle.
And probably really depressing, right? Like hard to take.
I mean, seeing the pollution as it exists today is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But what is very positive is that we have the technology to do something about it.
That's great.
We can recycle. It's about educating the way we recycle. It's about not throwing packages away that are contaminated, so have food still in them and that kind of thing. It's really been fascinating doing this piece.
Do you know when it's going to air?
I think sometime early June.
Oh, great. So pretty soon.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. But one of the latest kind of interesting things for me was this concept of green fence where, you know, we used to ship all of our plastic to China.
Yeah.
And now the Chinese are saying, we don't want it. It's like, keep your own trash. Because literally what's happening is we're shipping it all over there and it's contaminated with, like, you know, leftover yogurt in the yogurt pots and, you know, that kind of thing. And the Chinese want clean recyclables. You know, they just want to be able to crush it, you know, flake it, put it back into being a product. And they don't want to have to clean it and sort it.
Yeah, because that's like manual labor that's just expensive.
Very expensive and a waste of their time, because what ends up happening is those contaminated packages just end up on Chinese landfill. So we're basically just kicking the problem down the road.
Yeah, because by then it's like there's so much in there, it's all dried, it's impossible to get out. It's that's and there's no machine that just does that.
No.
There's people have to go through and do that. They have to sort it by hand.
They have to sort it, they have to wash it. It's energy intensive.
Yeah.
It's a pain. So it ends up on landfill.
Interesting. I still like the idea of boxed water. Although I still think the boxes have like a plastic lining. I could be wrong though.
They
don't quote me on that.
Yeah. There are some packages that are so complex, you know, with their layers of various different materials that it just makes it impossible to recycle.
Yeah, where it's almost worse. You're like, oh, but it's paper, but oh, it's lined in plastic. So I would love to see a container for water that was fully biodegradable. Just a fully... Because plastic's recyclable, but it's not biodegradable. But part of the problem is that it needs to be impermeable to water.
Yeah, I love biodegradable products. I just think it's amazing, like, especially with the amount of chips we consume. There was a company years ago, I did a piece on it for the BBC, where they were taking the leftover potato pulp from chips, which is a lot of pulp.
And when you say chips... Here you mean French fries, right?
I actually don't.
Oh, you actually
converted.
Mean chips. Gotcha.
Yeah, I got that one sorted. I'm still struggling with the other ones, but fries,
like chips. Okay, cool. Got it.
So crisps, as we call them, chips. Chips, right?
Yeah, chips. Yeah. You're right.
So the pulp goes into making these packages because essentially starch is great for packaging,
and they already have it left over.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so smart.
So they can just turn that into biodegradable. You know, packaging for supermarkets. So, you know, you take your apples out of the carton, you know, in a few weeks, it's gone.
Actually, brilliant.
It takes a bit longer than that.
But still, if it will break down naturally, if microbes will eat it, if animals will eat it, it's always going to go back, you know, it's just going to go back into the cycle. It's the stuff that just sits in the landfills or in the ocean. It's the plastic is the worst one, really, because it does break down, but it just breaks down to smaller pieces of plastic.
Yeah,
over
and it actually
and
looks
over.
Like fish food.
Yeah.
You know, by the time it's battered and weathered out in the ocean where the conditions are really harsh, it just turns into these little flakes. And the fish look at it and they think, yum, that's going to be...
And then
you know, it looks like plankton, actually.
And then they're just packed full of it.
Yeah. And you know what? Like, you know, your heart could break for the fish, but, you know, we're eating the fish, so...
And even if we're not eating those fish, we're eating the fish that eat those fish. Like, it still gets back to us.
Yeah.
And it's a problem we created. And then we're obviously reaping, I guess, the consequences of that. Huge bummer. Let's talk about something happy. What's your next story going to be on? Do you know yet? What are you working on right now?
I actually don't know.
Cool.
That's
a good place to be in, trying to figure out what to do next. That's
yeah,
fun.
And there's like a lot of change going on mm-hmm. at the network. Yeah. Some really exciting big new things. So we'll see where that takes us all.
Cool. I think right now I'm doing a GMO story. I started that and actually shot quite a bit of it. I did one shoot on an interesting story about MDMA. We'll see where that goes.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll continue that story or if other correspondents will do other portions of it, but that should be really interesting too. Fun stuff, fun topics.
It's been really, really fascinating. I've done such a diverse range, but I've also done many stories that are really like, you know, play to my expertise.
Oh yeah, one of my favorites visually is the wind tunnel that you did. Like it was tornadoes, right? Not hurricanes. Tornado story, and which also is like after my own heart as a Texan. I love tornadoes. I mean, we have a love hate relationship with tornadoes, obviously, but gorgeous. Like not only super fascinating, visually just so stunning. And they always use that one shot of you in the wind tunnel in all of the promos because it's just so stunning.
That was my very first film, The Techno.
It was?
Yeah. So like, you know, arrived in LA, all my bags packed from London. And they were like, okay, you're going to Oklahoma.
And you're like, what? What's in Oklahoma?
And then I found out like a bunch of tumbleweeds and a whole lot of wind. And it was just crazy because like that lab is one of the biggest in the world and they can actually recreate this amazing force of nature that is so complex. I mean, it's a three-dimensional spinning thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's difficult enough to create it on a computer screen.
Yeah.
So like to be able to create it in real life was fascinating. And it didn't take much actually. It was like 60 fans and like something like 60 metal veins, and they could adjust the angle of the veins so they could like control the twist.
Interesting.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was just like, oh my God, it was really interesting for me because I had been on the cutting edge of like computation for so many years doing my doctorate, and it was like going back to basics, but it wasn't basic. It was like really sophisticated and pioneering.
But they were still using pretty basic
elements to create this.
Something very technical.
Yeah.
And
but to get it right was like a real art.
And so what does it feel like? I mean, you were standing in it.
Yeah. I can't imagine what it must be like to be in EF 4 or 5 strength winds, because I was in EF 3 strength winds, which was already powerful enough.
Yeah, it's still very dangerous.
And you can like, you know, you can feel the force lifting you and kind of like, you know, to actually feel that airflow against your skin was chilling. It was just amazing.
And you were in kind of a safe version. I mean, you were in a more laboratory kind of atmosphere, and there was nothing in the wind. In a real tornado, it's full of basically shrapnel.
Yeah, well, the EF scale is not about like the speed or the danger. It's really about how much debris. How do you say it here?
Debris.
Yeah. is being carried in the tornadoes. And that's how you measure the scale. So 5 is like you're carrying 2x4 timbers and, you know, cows.
And, exactly. Tractors. Like, and
your car.
So insane.
Yeah.
But I mean, stunning. Like just so stunning, almost beautiful in a very dark
kind of way. Very beautiful.
Yeah.
With really horrific consequences.
Exactly. Just this thing that really makes you step back and respect nature in a way that maybe you haven't in a while. Maybe you've been living your life, you've been a city person.
I've only ever been in like really strong winds in London, which might be categorized as, you know, hurricane 1 or 2 or 3 or something. But nothing like that. And actually,
we get batshit weather in America.
You really do. What's that about?
I know. It's like in Florida, they get hurricanes. They get the worst lightning storms. In the south, in Tornado Alley, we get these crazy tornadoes. Over here in California, I guess it's not weather, but in California, we get these horrible earthquakes. Oh, yeah. We get the wildfires. It was crazy.
And so I was at the Institute of Building and Home Safety in, where was it? Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And in there, like that was a gigantic test chamber as well. And they were recreating all kinds of extreme weather. And that was, in my opinion, even more stunning because they were able to create wildfires and like have floating ash and then create monsoon rains and hurricanes. Like there was a wall of like 100 and something fans just like creating these hurricanes.
And it was to test whether like the windows could withstand it. Yeah, whether the
they
doors
had life-size houses in there and they were just testing the houses to destruction and like figuring out how they could nail roofs on more effectively and create windows that could withstand, you know, impact and stuff like that. What it was basically a giant toy box.
I know,
engineers.
What a fun job.
I know. I said to them, I was like, if you ever have a space for an engineer, like, can you consider me? Because honestly, I could do that for a job.
Oh, that's so
you're
cool.
You're just coming up. It's so creative. Like, you're just coming up with ways to
break
recreate
shit. And then,
yeah. Nature.
And then fix it. Yeah, exactly.
Copy Mother Nature, you know.
Oh, that's so cool. And try and make shit that can sort of withstand Mother Nature.
Absolutely. And I sometimes it's the weirdest, simplest stuff. Like, you know, rather than hammering your nails straight, you hammer them in a diagonal. And for some reason, that takes extra force.
Mm-hmm.
And
or like allowing something to be able to withstand a twisting force just a little so that when the wind is, you know, if it's hammering it straight on, it causes a lot of damage. But if it can take just a little bit of wiggle,
yeah,
then all of a sudden it can handle those that wind strength in
absolutely
a different way.
And that is the beauty of these test chambers, mm-hmm, because you don't get to find sometimes very simple solutions to complex problems unless you test things. It's kind of like, you know, who would have thought that an oak tree would be more likely to fall down in a hurricane than a flimsy little, you know, sapling?
Yeah.
That, you know, so...
But because
it's
kind
so of
rigid
counter,
and it's so, it yeah has so much surface area. Oh, that's yeah so interesting.
And it's so rooted and it's like, yeah, I'm not blowing down.
And it's like, yes, you are, bitch. That's crazy. Well, that's fascinating. This is so much fun, Shani. I just realized that we've been going for a whole hour, which means,
wow.
I know, which means it's kind of towards the end. And I can't let you leave without doing the same closing thing that I do with all of my guests, even though I'm so bummed. I like don't want to end it. So I always ask my guests the same two questions, and they're about the future in whatever context you'd like to answer, whether it's personal, global, whatever. I want to know, what is the thing when you look to the future that you're most concerned about? And on the flip side of that, what are you most, you know, excited about or optimistic about?
I think future-wise, and speaking from a scientific point of view, mm-hmm, I really hope that, you know, all the great scientists and technologists of our time put that brain power towards good things. Because it has been kind of really disheartening seeing how great minds end up, you know, turning their attention towards defense and war and that kind of thing. So mm-hmm, I'm really hoping that we can start using our innovation and our brilliance to just improve the quality of our lives.
Yeah.
It's kind of a really ideal, kind of fantastical type of concept, but I hope that for our future.
And I think that to some extent we do, but you're right. I think in the bigger picture, this idea, I think it comes down to people more than anything. It comes down to understanding that, you know, like a personal mantra of mine is that we're only as strong as the weakest among us. And so looking at where we have these weak spots, whether it be economically or with disease or, you know, hunger, insecurity in these areas, who is really suffering? And if the people who are suffering the most were elevated, we would all benefit from that. Yeah. You know what I mean? We never think that way. We always think in this competitive, like, let's keep elevating the roof.
Yeah.
Instead of bringing the floor up with them. And I know that science can solve those problems.
Me too. Like, I really believe that science can solve a lot of the conundrums we face today. And because of greed and power and, you know, a fight for that, you know, we're planting fuel instead of, you know, food.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of thing. And I just hope that we don't get too ahead of ourselves on that front.
I agree. I think a lot of people listening probably agree too. Shani, this was so much fun. Before we go, will you let the people who are tuning in know where they can see your work, where they can find you on Tay interwebs? Mm-hmm. You know, give them all the contacts you're comfortable giving them, your Twitter,
yeah,
your whatever.
So I need to remember all this.
I know,
stuff,
right?
Because I'm like terrible. Okay, Instagram, I love.
Great.
Because I love like pictorial things. So mm-hmm, I can be found on @Dr. Shani Somara. And then Facebook, I think, is Shinny Somar. And then Twitter is at Shinny Somar.
And help me with this because I work on this show. But Techno, like K-N-O-W Techno, yeah, on Al Jazeera America airs. When does it air?
I think it's Monday now. It changes a lot.
It changes a lot. We think it's on Mondays.
Go to the website.
Yes, check your local listings. You probably have Al Jazeera America. The carriage has gotten really good in the last kind of year. So you probably actually have it on your cable provider. Go to the website. You can see cool blog posts and accompaniment pieces for all of the stories that we do on Techno. And then you can also figure out where and when.
Yeah, and you can see it all around the world now because we're airing, aren't we, in England?
You're right, because we're
on Al Jazeera English.
Yeah, syndicated on Al Jazeera English. So that's 300 million homes.
Wow.
Isn't that insane?
It's a lot.
I know. And I got listeners. I was just looking yesterday at some of my stats for one of my episodes, and I've got mostly English-speaking countries right now, but definitely listeners all over the world. A lot of listeners in the UK, in Australia, in Canada, and then also in a couple places like Germany and Sweden and a few kind of European countries. And then as you go down, though, I've got listeners in, you know, places that you would never think, like in Kenya and some of the more, I guess, westernized parts of Africa.
Yeah.
But I definitely have listeners in some countries in Africa, in some countries in the Middle East where...
India.
Yeah, definitely. Where I'm like, don't get caught listening to me and all of my blasphemy. So thank you guys so much for listening. We have to thank you for your support.